So thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here. And thank you, Harold, and all my other friends who have spent the day regaling me with toys in their labs. So I want to draw your attention to a part of gravitational wave detection that has sort of emerged in the last 5 to 7 years as something that we hadn't fully recognized earlier on, which is that there are quantum opportunities in the process of detecting gravitational waves. And I wanted to sort of walk you through that. So what I would like to do is that by the end of the hour, to convince you that there are really two revolutions going on here. So gravitational wave detectors are being built, have been built, and they are about to open up for us a new window to directly observe gravitational radiation. Now, it turns out that these detectors are the most sensitive position meters ever constructed. And along with such precision comes the possibility to study another whole new field, which is the field of macroscopic quantum mechanics, which is what does quantum mechanics look like in human scale objects? So really, my talk is going to have sort of highlight two kinds of quantum opportunities. The one is to do with applications of quantum optics techniques. And here what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you how we prepare very special quantum states of light that help us to make better gravitational wave detectors. And then in the second part of my talk, I'm going to show you how we use some of the features of the gravitational wave detector itself as a tool for study of quantum mechanics on human scales. So it's tall order, and in the middle of all of this, I also have to tell you a little bit about gravitational waves and their astrophysics we do with it. So this is going to be quite the tour. All right, gravitational waves were predicted in 1916 by Einstein, and an indirect detection of these waves, of this radiation, led to a Nobel Prize in 1993. What they are ripples of the space-time fabric itself. And what that means really is that as a gravitational wave propagates through space, it stretches and squeezes the space-time transverse to its direction of motion. So if the gravitational wave is propagating out to you, the space-time is squeezing and stretching as it propagates outward. Now, the amount of the squeezing and stretching of space-time is quantified as a strain, which is a change in length per length, as given by the amplitude of the gravitational wave. So H is the amplitude, delta L is the amount by which a space-time distance L will shrink or stretch as the wave of amplitude H goes by. Now, gravitational waves that we would hope to measure are emitted by massive objects that are necessarily extraterrestrial. The masses and densities required preclude any kind of sort of terrestrial laboratory source. Now, what you need, the ingredients of a gravitational wave is you need lots of mass and you need lots of acceleration. And put those two things together and some of the very warped and violent events in the universe turn out to be very good candidates for emission. So things like cosmic explosions or supernovae explosions or compact stars like black holes or neutron stars that are orbiting each other or eventually collide or get gobbled up by each other. Deformations on stars, mountains on stars can be good emitters. Now, it turns out no matter what you choose as your favorite source, when you ask what nature realistically would give you, an observer on the Earth, as the amplitude of that wave, you come up with a rather dismal number. Okay? So 10 to the minus 21 is the typical strain that we expect from a source like a neutron star binary that is in the Virgo cluster, so some distance away from us, 50 million light years away from us. Now, even though that sounds like an absurd mission to measure such a small strain, it turns out that absurdity abounds all over the planet, and we have a number of observatories that are attempting to not only measure this radiation, but then to do astrophysics with it. So the two in the United States are the LIGO detectors. They're LIGO stands for Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, and they are kilometer scale detectors. A LIGO is 4 kilometers long. Remember, if you are trying to measure a change in length per length for a given amplitude, making your detector longer makes your job easier. So long detectors, kilometers long. The LIGO ones are in Washington State and Louisiana. A 600-meter long detector in Germany. Virgo is a 3-kilometer long detector in Italy. And then these are some planned detectors, LCGT in Japan. AKIGA is the acronym for the Australian consortium that hopes to build a detector. And then two with quick question marks. LISA is a space-based detector that has recently fallen off the NASA horizon, hence the question mark. And INDIGO is an Indian consortium that is working hard, and we'll know just in a few weeks whether a LIGO-like detector will be constructed in India. So these are LIGO, GEO, and Virgo. These four observatories are operational and have been in the last decade. Now, if you look at any one of these detectors, this is sort of the thing you would see in its guts. You start off with the laser. You have a beam splitter that splits half the light to transmit through it and half the light to reflect. Some kilometers away, usually in the case of LIGO, 4 kilometers away, you have a mirror over here and over there. And these two mirrors reflect the light back towards the beam splitter. And then here at the output, we simply measure the interference of the light. So we simply look at the path length changes as given by the interference pattern. Now, we add a few extra features to this detector. The one is a mirror here and here, and this mirror is facing the end mirror. So each of these intermediate mirrors is facing the end mirrors, and that enhances our sensitivity. And the way to think of it most simply, and these objects are called optical cavities, and the simplest way to think of this optical cavity is if you sandwich your own head between two mirrors, you see multiple images of yourself, so you see multiple reflections. And that's simply what these cavities are for. The light that's trapped in here reflects multiple times between these two mirrors before it leaks out. So if a gravitational wave comes by and stretches the arm, you sample that stretching by the number of bounces. So it's just it's a sensitivity-enhancing technique, but it will play an important role in some of the things I'll talk about later. Now, the other thing you'll see is that the mirrors are of this interferometer hang like pendulums. And the reason for this is twofold. The one is that you would like the mirror to be free to respond to the passing gravitational wave. And above the resonant frequency of the pendulum, the mirror acts like a free particle. So we typically tune our pendulum frequencies to be around 1 hertz. So by the time we enter the measurement band, which for terrestrial detectors is typically around 100 hertz, this acts like a free particle. The other thing, of course, that it helps with is that if you have external forces that drive the suspended mirror here, those forces transmit very poorly to the mirror itself above its resonant frequency. So it acts like a nice filter for vibrations as well. And then the last thing to mention is that we use very powerful lasers. And the reason for that is that at this output here, the signal that we're measuring due to the motion of the mirrors scales with the laser power, whereas the noise scales as the square root of the power. And this is a property of quantum-limited laser light. It turns out that the quantum-limited laser light is Poisson-distributed, so if you make a measurement that involves n photons, your noise scales as the square root of n. And this is a property, a quantum property of the light. It comes from the fact that photons come in quanta. So a quantum noise measurement, a limited measurement here, requires that if we want better signal-to-noise ratio, we should use more laser power. Okay? So these are the prominent features of a detector in this cartoon. And now I'll just give you a tour of an observatory where you'll see a little bit of the real thing. So this is the LIGO Observatory in Louisiana. It's L-shaped, and the central building houses the laser and a whole host of other technical systems. And then 4 kilometers away, the laser beam shoots through a vacuum tube 4 kilometers long in this direction and 4 kilometers long in that direction, reflects off mirrors at the two ends here, is recombined on the beam splitter, and we make our measurements at the corner here. Now, if you look at the beam tubes themselves, These are stainless steel tubes, about 1.2 meters in diameter, and the whole interferometer is operated in high vacuum. And if you're wondering why, I mean, one very simple reason is that the air currents would change the phase, would change the refractive index of the light, and therefore our phase sensitivity by more than this 10 to the minus 18 meters that we're aspiring to measure. Okay. Now, the beam tubes are protected by concrete housings, and this was a good thing to have done. I guarantee you this is not a Photoshop picture. This is at our Washington Observatory, recognizable by the fact that it's in a desert. It's east of Seattle in the high desert. And this is a patrol car that came over this dune and simply did not notice that there was a 4-kilometer-long concrete tube running through the desert. Now, if you go inside of one of these buildings, you see structures like this. So keeping in mind that our job is only twofold in making a good gravitational wave detector. The one thing we have to do is take these mirrors and make them protect them so much, shield them so well from external forces that they respond only to the small perturbations that come from the passing gravitational wave. And the other is we need to make very, very good laser light to be able to measure the position of those mirrors. So these structures here, each of these vacuum chambers houses one mirror, and the mirrors, each of them, this is quite a large structure. If I were to stand here, the top of my head is below this row of viewports right here. Inside of them are the vibration isolation systems for the mirrors. Here is one example, which is recognizable to some. It's a set of springs and masses and a spring mass system similar to the shock absorbers in your car. So this is a vibration isolation system. From such a system is suspended the mirrors of LIGO. As I showed you in the cartoon, they are suspended as pendulums. So here is a mirror. This is from the first phase of LIGO. It's about 25 centimeters in diameter, 10 kilograms mass. And what you can't see in this picture is it's suspended from some very thin wires like a pendulum. Here's a zoom in of the mirror. Here is the other important piece of our detector, the laser itself. Remember, we have to have very good laser light in addition to our very still mirrors, and this will feature prominently in the rest of my talk. And finally, if you were sitting in the control room at a LIGO observatory, it would look like this. This is an entire wall of projected data. A person, you can see the head of one person sitting in front of the monitor here. And when you do all of those things, you put it all together and make it work, you would get a detector with the following performance. So here in this graph, on the horizontal axis, I have frequency. And frequency runs from 10 hertz to 10 kilohertz, so human audio band. And on the vertical scale here, I've drawn the strain noise. And so what you can notice is this red curve here was the initial target sensitivity of the very first phase of the LIGO detectors. And in fact, these detectors were operated at that sensitivity, as shown by the blue curve, in the time frame around 2007. Between 2007 and 2009, we made... Oh, I got this thing ticking again. I'm an experimentalist, so I'm used to such things. But that one didn't work. So hopefully I'm the only one who can hear it, and I'll try to ignore it. 2 years later, some improvements were made to the LIGO detectors where we realized the green curve. And that is the sensitivity of this first phase of detectors. Now, I don't want to say a whole lot about what limits detectors with this sensitivity, but I do want to talk a little bit about one noise source that's going to feature prominently. And that's at this at frequencies above about 100 hertz in this region where you see this sort of slanting straight line. This region is limited by the photon counting noise. It's limited by the quantum statistics of the laser light itself. Now, and at other frequencies, it's limited by thermal noise, which are the thermally driven fluctuations of our mirrors. And at very low frequencies, it's the residual of the seismic, of all the ground vibrations that we could not filter out with all our good isolation. Now, with this first generation of detectors, there has been almost 3 years of operation at varying sensitivities. There have been large number of published results, which includes searches for this whole host of sources that I won't say much about. But I do want to say here, in the interest of full disclosure, that there have not been any direct detections as yet. And this prompts us to ask about what can we do to make the next generation of detectors. So here is what we had going as into 2010. And starting right about a year ago, we have begun construction on the next phase of LIGO, which is called Advanced LIGO. And in this phase, the entire detector has been changed out for a very major upgrade that should come on the air again in the 2016-2017, thank you, time frame. And for our purposes today, the most important question to ask is, how did we go from this curve of initial LIGO to advanced LIGO? And in a nutshell, for our purposes, the only thing I will talk about is we found ourselves a bigger laser. Okay. Now, many, many other things happened that I'll just sweep under the rug. You're free to ask me afterwards, but I just don't have time to tell you all the various improvements. But let me just say what happens when you find a better, bigger laser. So in initial LIGO, the laser power was 10 watts. In advanced LIGO, the laser power is increased to 200 watts of 1064 nanometer, so near-infrared laser power. And indeed, just as we wanted, just as we designed, in this region where we're limited by the photon counting statistics, we get a better detector by a very substantial factor. Now, in the meantime, we also became clever about the thermal noise and the seismic noise, and they just fell off this curve. And then one other very important thing happened to our detector. We now have the quantum effects of the light in play here. And this quantum light must also have a back action on our measurement. So, simply understood, here's what happens. I have a lot more power in my interferometer. My mirror, by definition, is an object that's free to move. And when I take the photons that are striking the mirror and they impart momentum, that momentum now is kicking my mirror. So I increase the amount of power to make a stronger measurement, but the stronger measurement, due to this radiation pressure back action, also has a bigger back action on my measurement. So quite simply put, more power, so I get a better sensitivity in phase to the interference pattern I'm trying to measure. But now this increased number of photons is kicking my mirror, and my mirror, the object I'm trying to keep so still, is moving. So the rest of my talk is going to be about what can we do about this. This sounds like a quantum limit, and in fact, it even has a name. This dashed line that I draw in here is called the standard quantum limit. Now, every field has its own favorite standard quantum limit. This just happens to be ours in gravitational wave detection. And that should tell you it's not standard, because we can't come up with a definition we all agree on. I also want to tell you it's not a limit, okay? It's a benchmark. So let me tell you what's going on here. The idea here is that if I increase my laser power more, indeed this part of my curve will go down, but because the back action gets stronger, this part of my curve will go up. And this line simply is the locus of points at which those two noise sources cross each other per laser power. So it's nothing but a benchmark. We have techniques where you can do better than that, and I want to talk a little bit about how we get to this limit in experiments, and then how do we do better. So to answer that question, I first have to answer the question of where does this quantum noise come from? So here is a thought. Oh, I do have to define one quick thing, which is the quantum states of light before I tell you about this. So in classical electromagnetism, we're all very used to thinking of the electric field as a phasor. It has a known amplitude, which is the length of this arrow, and it has a known phase, which is the angle this arrow makes with the horizontal axis. But in the quantization of the optical field, we have to introduce Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And when we do that, what we do is we have to introduce that we can't perfectly know the amplitude and phase of our light. This is sort of a heuristic description of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle for light. It basically says we can't know the tip of this phasor perfectly well. And in fact, the thing I've drawn here where you have a circle, which is equal noise in amplitude and phase, is a laser state. It's called the coherent state. Okay? So the coherent state is laser light. Now, there's nothing about the Heisenberg uncertainty principle that precludes me from making what's called a squeeze state. So a squeeze state is simply one where I take that uncertainty circle and I squeeze it along one direction. In this case, I've squeezed it along the amplitude. I've squeezed it along the length of this arrow. And as long as I make sure that I stretch it in the opposite direction so that the area of the ellipse is equal to the area of the circle, Heisenberg is preserved. And so this is called squeeze light. And the important thing to know about that is that that makes it different than classical light is that I must simultaneously do that. Look, if I had a classical amplifier and I put this state through there, the whole circle would grow bigger. In the squeeze state, I have to make sure that as I decrease the noise in one quadrature, I increase it in the other. Okay? And so, keeping that in mind, I now ask you a third question. Where does the quantum noise in the interferometer come from? One might say it comes from the laser, but then here is a very interesting conundrum. If I had a perfect interferometer where I have a laser beam that exactly splits in half, reflects off of these two mirrors, and then I can arrange this path length and this path length so that I have perfect destructive interference here. So I'm perfectly destructive interference, then I would argue that any noise, any fluctuations that came on my laser light cannot show up over here because they must go back towards the laser. All of the bright light is going back to the laser. All of its noise should go back to the laser. Now, it turns out when you make a measurement, that's not the case. You have noise over there. And this noise comes from vacuum fluctuations that enter this open port of the interferometer. So here is my vacuum field. Now notice how is it different than the coherent field that I drew a little while earlier? The stick's length went to zero. So basically, if you take laser light and take away all of the coherent amplitude, you will be left with a vacuum mode. This vacuum field enters the interferometer, and by the symmetry of the beam splitter, for the same reason that all of the laser light went back towards the laser, all of this field that entered here will come back at this output over here. Now, if I had a signal there, which this little yellow phasor is due to the motion of my mirrors, this signal would beat with the quantum vacuum fluctuations that are out here, and I would get shot noise. That is the origin of the noise. That's the origin of that popcorn noise that I measure at the output of my signal. It's the coherent signal field that beats with the quantum fluctuations, and I get a fluctuating phase. Now, you could also ask, where does the back action come from? Well, it turns out that the back action comes from the exact same thing, which is that the coherent light that's hitting my mirrors beats with the vacuum fluctuation that's over there, and that gives my mirror a fluctuating force. So it's quite a remarkable idea, right? It's basically saying that I have this object, in the case of LIGO kilogram scale object, whose motion is limited by vacuum fluctuations. And I will show you experiments along those lines. Okay. Now, what if I could inject into this, instead of a vacuum state, a squeezed vacuum state? And you can see in this case, I have judiciously squeezed it along the direction of my signal phasor. And now you can see that I can make a measurement with a better signal to noise than when I had just the vacuum state. I can only do that as long as I don't measure along this horizontal axis where my noise is much worse. Okay? And that's called a squeeze state injection. And so for the next few minutes, I want to spend some time showing you experiments of squeeze state injection into our detectors. So here's the idea. You start with a gravitational wave detector, and you make some measurement at its output that has your gravitational wave signal and shot noise on it. And now if you could instead introduce a squeeze light source where you inject squeeze light into the output of this detector, you should get an improved signal-to-noise ratio. And if you could do that in advanced LIGO, this is the same curve you've seen of advanced LIGO before, where you have shot noise here and radiation pressure noise and at low frequencies where the quantum fluctuations are shaking the mirror. If you could inject such a squeeze state, indeed, where you have your shot noise, you can make an improvement. This is not data. This is just a calculation. Data's coming next. Now, notice one other thing, that in this region where you have radiation pressure, you got worse. And the reason for that is that in this region, at these frequencies, which are limited by radiation pressure, you're sampling the long part of the ellipse. So here you have the nice small part of the ellipse, and here you're on its semi-major axis, so the noise got worse. Now, there are techniques to do globally better that I won't talk about. And the final thing is that what the squeeze light allows you to do is it also allows you to trade laser power. So here is a set of curves for the advanced LIGO detector where you can see that you can either your signal-to-noise ratio can be improved either by increasing your laser power or by injecting a squeeze state, which is this e to the minus r factor here, or both. And here is just a series of curves that show you can trade off power or you can use both to do globally better. So we decided to make this measurement. I won't show you quite the details of how a squeezer is put together. It's a complicated quantum optics beast. But what I will say is you start off with a laser light, and you take a tiny bit of this laser light that would normally go towards your interferometer, and you inject it into a second light source where you take some of this laser light and you frequency double it. So we start with infrared light at 1064 nanometers, we frequency double it to make green light at 532 nanometers. Then you take that green light and you put it through a second nonlinear optical process in which this green light will have an intensity-dependent index shift in this material and will cause the outcoming light to create two photons at 1064, so energy is conserved, and those two photons are correlated. And that's how you make a squeeze state. The squeeze state is made by making photon pairs that are correlated so that you can take arbitrary combinations of their noise and add or subtract them. Okay? And you inject that into your interferometer, which is shown here in a little bit more detail. Here is the squeeze source that we use, and this experiment was done on the LIGO detectors, on the initial LIGO detectors that I showed you just before the advanced LIGO detector installation was begun. Now, this is a slide to sink it back to theorists who put up very, very complicated slides that I can never follow. But I'm really not going to walk you through this. This is just to show you that the experiment has a fair number of bells and whistles. And here is the result. So this now is plots you're used to seeing, frequency on this axis. And here, instead of strain, I just use displacement. And here is an experiment that we did in November of last year, so just a few months ago. And I've written preliminary here because this is unpublished and it has to still be published by the collaboration, where the red curve shows the LIGO detectors that were operated in that enhanced LIGO phase, and the blue curve shows what we were able to do when we injected the squeeze state, which gave us a 25% improvement in the signal-to-noise ratio. And we were also able to show that this improvement in squeezing goes down all the way to 150-ish hertz, where we are shot noise limited. And beyond that, at frequencies lower than that, we expect no improvement because that's not quantum noise of the laser at those frequencies anymore. Now, I just want to say, add a third curve here. So the red curve in this case is the curve that we had without squeezing in November 2011. The green curve is the curve that LIGO was operated with during its sixth science run. So that was in the period between 2009 and 2010. And then the blue curve is the curve we just got a few weeks ago with squeezing. And I just want to sort of drive home the point that with squeezing, we now have the greatest broadband sensitivity that a gravitational wave interferometer has ever achieved. So we now believe that this is a technology that is completely ready to use in advanced LIGO, and I expect it will be in there very early on in the game. And so what is the implications for astrophysics? So astrophysics is different in different frequency bands for LIGO. And so in the highest frequency, so above 300 hertz, so 300 hertz to few kilohertz, the important things that one can study are things like the nuclear equation of state. So you can actually look at a pair of neutron stars that are colliding with each other, and you can ask questions like, what does matter behave like at those nuclear densities? And those would be informed by very high frequency measurements. So squeeze states, where we've shown improvements above about 150 hertz, are very important for those kinds of tests where you're looking. And here is a little plot that just shows one interesting thing. Here's frequency on this axis. And this is a plot from Jocelyn Reed that basically shows that if you use different models of black holes that collide, you really can't tell the difference between the different models at low frequencies. But as you get to higher frequencies, they really start to diverge. And so having greater sensitivity at those frequencies is very valuable. So squeezing is helpful for that. Now, at frequencies between 50 and 300 hertz, it's also a little bit helpful because that is where most of the end states of some of these neutron star and black hole binaries will occur, and that from there you can learn about their populations. But there's a very important frequency band that's below 50 hertz. And in that frequency band is the place where you actually can start to measure the physical parameters of black hole and neutron star binaries, because at those very low frequencies, the binary spends a long time in your detection band, a half hour. At the very end, at the merger phase, at a few hundred hertz, it's seconds. So this is a very important band for those kinds of measurements, for measurements that would involve black holes that are neither solar mass nor supermassive black holes like those at the center of galaxies, but, you know, a few tens of solar mass to hundreds of solar mass black holes, and also primordial gravitational waves from the very early universe. So I hope I've convinced you that squeeze states, we can make them in our labs, we can put them in our detectors, and we can make improvements at these frequencies. And now for the rest of the talk, I want to try and work on what can we do at these lower frequencies where we have the quantum back action, where we have this radiation pressure noise. Okay? So I'll just remind you, so now we're going to be concentrating on the radiation pressure side of things. And that brings us to the topic of optomechanics. So when radiation pressure dominates in your system, that's certainly something very important for everything I've said so far for making improvements in gravitational wave detectors. But it actually turns out that it's also an opportunity to study quantum effects in these macroscopic systems. The fact that you can observe this back action directly on the motion of the mirror is the thing I talked about earlier, where you have this macroscopic object that's wiggling around because of vacuum fluctuations. There are interesting things to study there. One can also, in such systems, actually generate squeeze states of light. One can think about entanglement of mirror and light quantum states. And finally, as a whole industry of groups that are also measuring quantum states of these of these mirrors as tools for quantum information science and fundamental quantum research. So here is a very small subsection of the menagerie of devices that's around. So this is optomechanics. In every single case, I'm showing you something that you can think of as a mirror. And in every single case, this mirror at different scales is going to be coupled to a light field. And the idea in all of these experiments is to use the radiation pressure of the light field, or use the quantum properties of the light field to manipulate the motion of the mirror. Okay? So starting with picogram scale NEMS devices, so you can sort of walk your way over to the toroidal microcavity resonators, which are in sort of the 10 picogram scale. These are the whispering gallery modes of a little silicon disk right here. People are working with silicon nitride membranes as mirrors that are in the 10 to the minus 8 gram range. Atomic force microscope cantilevers are used for these measurements. Recently, people have made these lithographically manufactured trampoline mirrors. And then here at the microgram scale are mirrors where this picture is not too clear, but you'll see a clearer one recently, where people, crazy people, have even made little mirror pendulums that are on these microgram scales. Those crazy people happen to be in my group, hence I can be so disparaging. And then even crazier people have sought to do this with 1 gram mirrors, also in my group. And then the nuttiest of them all are people who are trying to do this quantum optomechanics with kilogram scale mirrors. So I'm going to walk you through some of the things that one can do with radiation pressure and mirrors at these different scales. And then I'll wrap up by telling you how this is useful for gravitational wave detectors. So the very first thing is, all of these experiments are trying to couple this radiation pressure force very strongly to the mirror motion. And in the very classical regime, you can use the radiation pressure force to alter the dynamics of the mirror. So you can make forces that look like springs, you can make forces that look like damping, and you can manipulate the dynamics of the mirrors. And that can be purely classical. But then you can also use the quantum properties of these mirrors. Remember, the one thing we know how to do very, very well is to make nice, beautiful quantum limited light. And one can ask, can one then take the beautiful quantum properties of the light and transpose that onto the mirror? So people are also working on this in my group and many others, on these ideas of reaching that standard quantum limit and producing quantum states of these mirrors. Now, the one overarching enemy that comes along when you try to do this, when you try to make quantum radiation pressure dominate the motion of your mirror, is thermal noise. Every one of these mirror systems, any mechanical system, has dissipation that causes it to vibrate due to thermal fluctuations. And in advanced LIGO is no different. Here is a more comprehensive advanced LIGO curve, where you notice that this red curve is the thermal noise of the advanced LIGO mirror. So it is really flirting with this quantum noise at an advanced LIGO as well. And the reason that this comes about basically is that if you have some mechanical system at some temperature, usually it is tethered to a thermal bath. If it's at room temperature, it's tethered to that thermal bath through the mechanical oscillation frequency and the mechanical damping. And what we want to do is we want to take that mechanical tether and make it very weak compared to an optical tether. So a laser beam is effectively zero temperature bath. And if we could take the mirror and couple it more strongly to the laser light than it is to its own mechanical support, we can decouple it from this room temperature bath and thereby cool it. Okay? So this is the equivalent of optical cooling and trapping of mirrors, the same way as people do for ions and atoms. How do we do that? Well, I've introduced you to optical cavities before. So in this case, this is just a funny variant of a LIGO optical cavity. You have a large input mirror, which we assume is just massive enough to be stationary. And then we have a light mirror that's on some sort of oscillation stage. So here is the mechanical tether, the spring or the pendulum, whichever way you do it. And then we couple a very strong optical field where we build up a lot of laser power in this cavity. And we try to then decouple this mirror from the mechanical room temperature bath to this cold optical bath. And the way that we do that is shown over here. This Lorentzian curve is the resonance of the light in the optical cavity. So as we change the length of this optical cavity on the horizontal axis, the light that's stored inside this cavity comes into resonance and then falls out of resonance as we scan across it. And if we were able to operate on this blue side over here, notice what happens. If your cavity gets a little bit longer, you drop down in power. As you drop down in power, the radiation pressure force that's pushing on your mirror drops, and the mirror moves back in. That's a restoring force. Mirror moved out from whatever. You could have twanged it yourself, pull it away. And the radiation pressure force goes down, and that pulls it in. And that is, in fact, an optical spring. That is exactly how one makes an optical spring in this region. And the one downside of doing that is that the optical field that's inside this cavity does not respond instantaneously to the motion of the mirror. There's some delay. And the delay corresponds to an imaginary term, which is damping. So one can, with this optical field, can make a spring term and also a damping term. And if you go to the other side of the cavity resonance, the same thing happens, except all the signs are reversed. Okay? So the message to carry away is, if you go to the blue detuning side, which is on this side of the cavity, you get a very strong restoring force. If you go to this side of the cavity, you get a very strong damping force. And now I'll show you experiments that exploit this idea, and I'll start with our gram scale mirror experiments. So here is a cartoon of the experiment. Things that you can very quickly recognize: a big heavy mirror that we ignore, and then a light gram, 1 gram mirror that is hanging as a pendulum and separated by about a meter from this big mirror. Now, we start off with a lot of laser power, a few watts. We split our laser into 2 colors. And the only reason to do this splitting into 2 colors is we use 1 color to make the optical spring, so we blue detune. We make the other color, red detune the other color to make the damping. So with this combination of trapping potential from the light and damping potential from the light, we optically trap and cool the mirror. Okay, that's the principle. And this basically just shows data for that. On the left side, I've basically drawn the response of the mirror. And what you see is, on the upper plot, there's magnitude, and it looks just like a harmonic oscillator. It has a mechanical resonance that's off this picture on the black dash curve at about 170 hertz in this case, and it's falling off as 1 over f squared as a function of frequency. And then every one of these subsequent colored plots is as we turn up the optical trapping and damping potentials. Okay, so as we turn up the blue and red shifted light, we can increasingly shift the mechanical resonant frequency from 170 hertz all the way down, in this red case, to 5 kilohertz. So here's what's happening. Quite simply, you have 170 hertz mechanical spring, and then you're ratcheting up your optical springs till it completely dominates the mechanical spring and pushes your frequency out to 5 kilohertz. Now, if you ask what is the spring constant associated with that mechanical spring, it's about 2 million newtons per meter. So a way to understand this is that if I took that 1 meter long optical beam that's between my 2 mirrors, and I could just pull the light out and instead put a diamond rod of the same dimensions in there, my light spring is stiffer. Okay. Now, I wouldn't put the diamond rod in there for another reason, which is that, of course, the diamond rod has thermal noise. It's a mechanical thing. So this is a way of cooling macroscopic objects with laser cooling and decoupling them from the thermal environment. In this phase of the experiment, we were able to show that we could cool a room temperature 1 gram mirror to below a Kelvin along that motional degree of freedom, that oscillation degree of freedom of the pendulum. Now, we made some improvements to our experiment that come primarily from adding a second identical cavity. And this is very important because the previous version of the measurements I showed you were limited by laser noise. And so anytime you want to get rid of laser noise, one way to do it is to make a differential measurement where you send all the laser noise back towards the laser and you use the this antisymmetric port output here, just as we do in LIGO. So it's starting to look more like a LIGO detector, but it's an important piece to cancel laser noise. And then we were able to cool this mirror down to under 1 millikelvin in the same way. Okay? Now, what this corresponds to in terms of the number of quanta of energy in this gram scale mirror, which is about the size of a dime, is about 35,000 quanta. So most would argue this is not as yet a terribly quantum object, and I would agree. So the next thing we asked ourselves, so let me just say where we're at with this experiment. So right now, the place where this experiment is, what we really want to do in an experiment like this is we would like to measure directly this quantum back action noise, the radiation pressure, the quantum radiation pressure fluctuations. And the blue curve shows where we are at the moment, and the black curve shows where we need to be. So we're quite close, but we are limited, as the pink curve shows, by the thermal noise of our oscillator. So in this experiment and many of the other experiments I showed you, thermal noise is a very, very real problem, and we have to be pretty clever to get rid of it, but that'll happen. So my next thing is, I wanted to then bring you to how well can we do with the kilogram scale mirrors in terms of using these ideas of optical trapping and cooling. So we repeated the same experiment I described to you earlier, where we optically trapped the mirror with the initial LIGO mirror. So here is a 10 kilogram mirror. It has a resonant frequency at 0.7 hertz, so below a hertz. And with optical feedback, we were able to bring that resonance out to 140 hertz and then turn on our optical damping field. And we were able to cool that mirror down to 234 quanta. So now things get more interesting. Right now we have this 10 kilogram object. And in this one motional degree of freedom, it has 230 quanta of energy remaining. Now, to keep in mind, what does this mean? When you get to one quanta of energy, it's in its quantum ground state. Okay? So we're getting into a more interesting regime here. Finally, with the microgram scale mirrors that we use in my lab, here you can see a slightly better picture. These are 100 micron big. These mirrors weigh about a quarter microgram. And they're suspended again by pendulum-like tethers. This is made out of aluminum gallium arsenide, which is which can be made into a Bragg reflector. And the thing that's important about this experiment, that's different from the other one that I showed you, is that without belaboring all the details, this experiment is capable of actually directly observing that standard quantum limit. Now, why do we wish to do that? Advanced LIGO should do that in the next half decade. Well, it turns out there are many proposals out there for going below the standard quantum limit with clever ideas that include things like squeezing, because now you know the limit that we call the quantum limit is a little manipulable. And so if we want to try those ideas, we first must make an experiment that can at least observe the standard quantum limit. So in that experiment, this is a detail of the experiment that I won't bore you with too much other than to say it looks like every other experiment. Small little mirror cantilever, large fixed mirror, large amount of optical power to couple strongly to the little cantilever mirror. The whole thing lives in a helium 4 cryostat, so we can cool it down to about 10 Kelvin. And in this experiment, we are also at a very interesting regime. Frequencies here are now in the kilohertz range. And the thing to notice on these data here, the pink and magenta curves are what we measure and expect for the thermal noise at room temperature. So the purple, the magenta curve is our model for the thermal noise. The red is what we measure. Similarly, the blue curve is our model for the thermal noise at 20 Kelvin. And the cyan data is what we measure. And finally, the black curve is what we would expect to see for the quantum back action. And you can see we can make no claim of that as yet, but this is a work in progress. So here is an experiment that eventually should see the standard quantum limit, but even before that, should be able to directly measure this, the quantum vacuum fluctuations pushing around the position of the mirror. So I want to end with acknowledging my amazing cast of characters. The squeezing work that was done on the Hanford detector was led by graduate students Sheila Dwyer and postdoc Lisa Barsotti. The gram scale mirror experiment is done by these four folks. The microgram scale mirror is done by these folks. And we have an amazing cast of collaborators who help us with this work. And of course, nothing would be possible without funding from our funding agency, the National Science Foundation. So I want to leave you with just one closing thought. So it's very clear that when the elusive gravitational wave is captured, there will be unprecedented tests of general relativity where we directly observe these promised ripples of space-time that Einstein himself hardly believed could be there. There's astrophysics to be done where there'll be direct observations of black holes, of cosmological gravitational waves. But the thing that was not predicted when we went down this road was that the precision needed to do these two things have suddenly opened up another opportunity for us, which is to start to do quantum optics and quantum optomechanics with these truly human-scale objects. I'll draw your attention to this object. It is the 40-kilogram mirror of Advanced LIGO. Now, if you recall, early on I told you Advanced LIGO will operate at the standard quantum limit, which means when we reach that sensitivity, this object is in its quantum ground state. So this is an unthought of but very very interesting possibility to exploit. And so all I can say is stay tuned.